Good morning, friend. Welcome into the Mike Allen Show. My pleasure to be with you here on this Thursday, May 19th. In the next couple of segments, after we come back from a commercial break a little later, we'll talk to Rodney Stark, who is the best-selling author of The Rise of Christianity. He's a professor at Baylor University, a professor of social sciences there, and has written also a Protestant Christian who is also opposed to anti-Catholicism that is not rooted in fact. And as someone who is a lover of history and was stunned by the constant accumulation of what he called anti-Catholic myths, he decided to do something about it, and he wrote a book called Bearing False Witness, Debunking Centuries of Anti-Catholic History, and we'll talk to him in the next couple of segments, conversation that I had with him yesterday. We'll also spin the Dollar Catechism wheel. We'll talk about our subtle devaluing of the lay vocation and also an interesting Indiana law. All that and more coming up on the program. My question of the day, I posted a link to an article. I haven't even read the article. So Shannon did the heavy lifting and called in at the end of the last hour. But the name of the article from SmithsonianMag.com, did Neanderthals die out because of the paleo diet? Which, of course, the irony would be we're now embracing the paleo diet. Or is there a new fad one out there? Anyway, my question is, have you ever done a fad diet, whether it's South Beach, the grapefruit juice diet, or, the Atkins diet, the low-fat diet? Would love to hear from you. 573-4-BREAD-4, 573-4-BREAD-4. One of the funniest things I ever heard. Father Frank Bronner, you know, we have this bracketology with Father Bronner contest every year. He's a local priest. Father Frank, very self-effacing about his own girth, talks about the time he decided he was going to go on a juice diet, and he bought this, like, $200 juicer. One of the funniest things I've ever heard in a homily was him talking about that, because he started talking to, he kept saying the word juicer over and over. He was saying, what was I thinking? A juicer. And I guess he discovered or realized in the midst of it that he was saying the word juicer a lot. And all of a sudden he just riffed on that and went, we're talking about practice. Of course, many of the sports fans in the crowd, mainly men, all chuckled because of the reference to the Allen Iverson press conference, and a lot of others, mainly women, scratching their heads. But I digress. Anyway, we were looking at the first reading in the last hour, or actually both readings today, not for the faint of heart, not touchy-feely, meme-ready quotes from Scripture, like the little kitten trying to hold on to a bar with an inspirational quote at the bottom. Pretty strong words from the Epistle of St. James. A warning to the rich. Actually, a command to weep and wail over your impending miseries. Judgment is, or what does it say? That needlepoint wall hanger in the warden's office in Shawshank Redemption. Judgment cometh, and that right soon. Sort of the theme of James' epistle. And the judgment is coming for the rich. Those who've stored up treasure on earth, as Jesus himself said, right, where moth and rust destroy and thieves break in and steal. You have stored up treasure for the last days. Behold, the wages you withheld from the workers who harvested your fields are crying aloud. And one of the things in the Catholic tradition is this understanding that there are sins that cry out to heaven. Because of their particular gravity. This is actually from the Catechism, 1867. The catechetical tradition also recalls that there are sins that cry to heaven. The blood of Abel, in other words, murder. The sin of the Sodomites from the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. The cry of the people oppressed in Egypt. And so slavery or bondage, the cry of the foreigner, the widow, and the orphan, and the injustice to the wage earner. And that last one, of course, taken from the letter to James. You hear a lot, perhaps sometimes, about the sins of the Sodomites, and you hear about the sins of the blood of Abel and of murder. don't hear quite as much these days about slavery or the cry of the foreigner, the widow, and the orphan, and particularly this one that's listed in James about withholding wages from the earner. Behold, the wages you withheld from the workers who harvested your fields are crying aloud, and the cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord of hosts. If we happen to be the type of person who has people in our employ, those are serious things to consider. In a day in which what was the stat I saw recently in terms of there was a graph that in which basically wages and productivity, the lines were kind of parallel with each other, close to each other, almost overlapping until about 40 years ago. And then productivity, that line continued to rise on the graph, worker productivity, and real wages leveled off. So now you've got a gap that continues with each passing year, because the truth is that we are not paying people enough. And this whole idea of a living wage has really been lost amidst all the debates about minimum wage with the Industrial Revolution. There used to be a concept, there is a concept in Catholic social teaching called a living wage. Persons being paid in such a way that they're able to support a family without the extreme anxiety and paycheck to paycheck perpetual cycle of instability and debt that seems to be a part of so much of experience there and the demise of the middle class. So something to take seriously, the pay that is given to workers. And this is where I think we as Catholics particularly have to be really careful that our love of supply side economics and our baptizing always of a libertarian capitalist viewpoint sometimes betrays the deeper principles of our Catholic faith, because if there's anything we can see consistently throughout church social teaching is just as socialism, government-imposed socialism, and the state owning the means of production and so forth is incompatible with a Christian culture and civilization. At the same time, so is a situation where fewer and fewer persons control the means of production, and you get this rising gap between the rich and the poor, with the middle class declining, and that's kind of where we are right now. So sort of a laissez-faire, invisible hand, free market capitalism as a pure reality, no more compatible with the Catholic faith than socialism, quite frankly. And then Jesus goes on in the gospel to say some pretty strong things as well about causing little ones to stumble. Whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, it would be better for him if a great millstone were put around his neck and he were thrown into the sea. Where is Buddy Jesus when you need him? And then he goes on to talk about if your hand causes you to sin, cut it off. It is better for you to enter into life maimed than with two hands to go into the unquenchable fire. In other words, I think with both the James reading and the Gospel of Mark reading, to take sin seriously in our lives, even the ones we think are little or private sins. There are no private sins, because we all impact one another, no doubt. We talked about sins that cry out to God for heaven, one of those being the blood of Abel or the murder of the innocent. That's part and parcel with the whole issue of abortion as well. What makes it such a travesty and such a crime against humanity is you don't get any more innocent of victims than the unborn child who's not seen the light of day, whose very right to life is snuffed out from the very beginning through no fault of their own. And so there's an interesting law I wanted to comment on out of the state of Indiana. This is from the Atlantic. Name of the article, State Mandated Mourning for Aborted Fetuses. That's not the most fair headline in the world there by Emma Green, I think, because it's not about the state's not trying to mandate how people feel. But here's what it says. Here's what will happen after a woman gets an abortion in the state of Indiana starting this July. She will be told verbally and in writing that she has the right to choose what she does with her aborted fetus. She will be given a list of her options for disposal and offered counseling. The fetus does not have to be named, but it will receive its own burial transit form, just like any dead body. This form will travel with it to a funeral home where it will be buried or cremated. There won't necessarily be a ceremony. The fetus may not get its own headstone or urn, but it will be laid to rest in the way of a human. Aborted fetuses in Indiana, nearly all smaller than a pea pod, will no longer be treated as medical waste. Now, typically, I think The Atlantic is a very fair-minded publication. And Emma Green, I've appreciated a lot of her writing. There's some pretty strong bias slipping in there on that language. Not that there's anything wrong with the word fetus, and I need to look this up during the break, what the actual etymological meaning of it is. I think it's not a dehumanizing term when we really understand what it is. But anyway, but the use of fetus there constantly, and as well as pointing out smaller than a pea pod, I would say, what does that have to do with it? Anyway, they will no longer be treated as medical waste. And that's an interesting, I think, a law, and I think a hopeful law, actually, that can have a subtle and gradual impact on people's sensibilities and the way they understand the unborn human person who has been destroyed through abortion, and perhaps maybe quicken a deeper awareness in the populace about the rights of the unborn. So maybe later in the show we'll get into that. When we get back, we'll be talking to Rodney Stark, Baylor professor, author, about anti-Catholic myths and what to do about them. This is The Mike Allen Show. Minutes past the hour. This song number one 40 years ago. Paul McCartney and Wings, Silly Love Song. 2 years later, they would have a number one hit with A Little Luck. It's probably my favorite Paul McCartney and Wings song. I kind of go back and forth. My wife and I have some arguments about this. She likes the song Coming Up. I can't stand it. She likes Simply Having a Wonderful Christmas Time. Makes me want to drive my car into a light pole. So, you know, but hey, that's what marriage is about, blending diverse viewpoints, the right one and the wrong one. 573-4-BREAD-4, 573-4-BREAD-4, if you want to chime in. Ever had a fad diet you've been on? Would love to hear about the results. You can text me if you want, 573-4-BREAD-4, or email me, mikeallenshow@gmail.com. Kim comments and says that she remembers back in high school being on a hot dog and bananas only diet. Wonder what that would be called. Hot dogs and bananas. Were you allowed to eat the bun? I can see if you didn't eat the bun, maybe, perhaps. Yeah, we got to do some research on that. Anyway, my conversation for the next couple of segments is with Rodney Stark. Rodney is a professor of distinguished professor of social sciences, and he's the co-director of the Institute for Studies of Religion at Baylor University and honorary professor of sociology at Peking University in Beijing, the author and co-author of a number of books in 17 different languages, including the best-selling The Rise of Christianity. His new book called Bearing False Witness, Debunking Centuries of Anti-Catholic History, in which he goes through systematically, he himself not a Catholic, to dismiss many of these claims that have gotten such traction in Western culture, and particularly in our Western culture of self-hatred in so many levels. So anyway, my conversation with Dr. Rodney Stark. So So, Dr. Stark, why did you write Bearing False Witness, Debunking Centuries of Anti-Catholic History?
Well, it's a funny story. I mean, it was kind of forced on me. I was writing other books, most of them having to do with medieval history, but some of them later. And I kept running into these things, widely believed claims of one sort or another, and discovering that they were completely false, that the consensus of good historians of our time say this is nonsense. And yet there they were, out there with many, many people repeating them, including historians of other periods. And so when I'd run into one of these, for example, like the Dark Ages, which turns out even the encyclopedias today now admit never happened. But when I'd run into one of these, I'd take a few pages and stop and get rid of it and then go on. And after a few years, I had so many of these piled up that I thought, you know, this is nonsense. I ought to do a book and face these head on, because they're just not going away, even though the fact is that the people who should know very well that they're not true.
As I say, I guess tell a falsehood long enough, finally it's as if it becomes true.
Well, yeah, and of course some of these have been believed for 400 or 500 years, you know. I mean, it's a lot of this stuff originated, of course, in the wars of religion, having to do with Protestant Catholics, early Reformation times, and the English and the Dutch made up nasty, nasty stories about Catholic Spain. I'm sure the Spanish probably responded, but theirs have been lost, and these have hung on. And they hung on partly because, of course, anti-Catholicism persisted. We shouldn't forget that it wasn't until 1871 that Catholics could be admitted to Oxford and Cambridge. Mm.
Is there some degree of truth to the old saw that the winners write history, and so because it was really the ultimately the English settlements that took root and prevailed here in the New World, for example, that we get that more British anti-Catholic slant?
Yeah, I think certainly that there's a lot too. I mean, this was originally a Protestant country and with a very British heritage, and of course that's, you know, we didn't get German histories or Italian histories or Spanish historians. We got English historians, and sure, that's where a lot of it came from. But the thing is, we've made up some of our own, and some of it's way too late to blame the English for. The notion about Columbus couldn't get funding for his voyage because the Catholic prelates believed that the earth was flat and his ships would fall off. That's not only just nonsense, but nobody had ever heard that story until 1828, when old Washington Irving, who invented the headless horseman, he made up the story and presented it as fact, and it just got into all the history books. But it's nonsense. Everybody knew the world was round. What Columbus didn't know was how big around it was. And in fact, if the Western Hemisphere hadn't been there and nobody knew it was there, he and his ships might as well have fallen off the edge of the earth, because nobody would have ever heard of them again.
Now, just to clarify that you are not a shill for the Catholic Church, you are not Catholic yourself, right?
No, I was raised a Lutheran. I heard every Sunday how awful the Catholic Church was.
One of the things I really liked in the book, right from the beginning, your opening chapter on anti-Semitism. I'm not a historian by any means, but you know, I do a lot of reading and stuff, and you would come across these tales of these awful pogroms, you know, against Jewish villagers, and so it was easy for me, even as a Catholic and somebody who converted to the Catholic faith, to say, well, this is just a dark part of our history, anti-Semitism, and to kind of accept the idea almost as though the Catholic Church created anti-Semitism. But you make the argument that anti-Semitism predated Christianity, predated the Catholic Church, and in some cases, the Church actually helped temper it.
Well, first of all, it did much predate. I mean, the Romans were very anti-Semitic, so were the Greeks. And this is, you know, if the Catholics are responsible, then a lot of those early Romans were secret Catholics even before the birth of Jesus. So, I mean, that just doesn't work. But the other thing is that, sure, the Church, all Europeans were anti-Semitic. That's not a secret. But there's a difference between having prejudice towards Jews and doing violent things. And when it comes to the violent part, the church stood four square. Many bishops risked their lives to save Catholics, particularly in the cities along the Rhine River, where governance was not strong and they had riots of all kinds. The church stood strong against any harm for Jews, and the sources for this are not Catholic historians, not European historians, it's Jewish historians. And it was Jewish chroniclers of the time who reported how the bishop took all the people into his palace and protected them and whatnot. Now, those are stories that need to be told.
We're talking to Dr. Rodney Stark, Distinguished Professor of the Social Sciences and Co-Director of the Institute for Studies of Religion at Baylor, the author of his new book, Bearing False Witness, Debunking Centuries of Anti-Catholic History. Let's talk about a few others. Of course, the Crusades always seem to come up, and certainly ever since 9/11, the Crusades have become rekindled in the popular imagination. Talk about where historians have gotten that wrong.
Well, you know, our president in February at the National Prayer Breakfast said, okay, we Christians shouldn't be on our high horse about, he wouldn't call it Muslim terrorists, but that's what he was referring to. He was like, we've done our pair of, you know, our bad things too, and like the Crusades. The first thing I would like to point out about the Crusades is that the Battle of Tours occurred when a huge Muslim army was smashed flat by Charles Martel and his army of Franks. What's important here is, where did that happen? It wasn't 100 miles south of Damascus. It was 100 miles south of Paris. Well, what was a huge Muslim army doing in France? Trying to colonize Europe. And that attempt went on for 400 or 500 years, and there was a lot of fighting back and forth. For centuries, the Muslims held Spain. They did take all of North Africa, which had been a Christian continent. They occupied southern Italy and Sicily for several centuries. And it wasn't until the Battle of Lepanto in 1571 that they were finally turned back permanently. So how come all of this it just gets passed over and we talk about the Crusades as Europe trying to colonize the Muslim world? Nothing of the sort. It was mostly defensive, trying to protect Christian shrines in Jerusalem and the lives of Christian pilgrims going to Jerusalem, and generally in response to this constant military pressure from the East. And the people who went were the heads of the great European families. They weren't a bunch of second sons and whatnot. They went at enormous cost to themselves. Some of them bankrupted themselves to go. They weren't expecting to get any land and loot because there wasn't anything out there. Most of them didn't return. Not because they stayed, but because they died. Somehow or other, all of this seems to get lost, and we talk about, well, this terrible thing we did. Well, we didn't do a terrible thing. No apologies necessary.
We'll be back in the next segment with more in my conversation with Dr. Rodney Stark, who's a professor at Baylor and the author of the book, Bearing False Witness, Debunking Centuries of Anti-Catholic History. When we get back, we'll talk a little bit more about the Spanish Inquisition. No one ever expects the Spanish Inquisition. We'll get into that here in just a minute. 573-4BREAD-4. Shoot me a text if you've got a comment. This is the Mike Allen Show. Don't go anywhere. 30 minutes past the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show here on this Thursday. More now with in my conversation with Dr. Rodney Stark, professor at Baylor and the author of the book, Bearing False Witness, Debunking Centuries of Anti-Catholic History. More of my conversation with Dr. Stark. Now, you don't contend, of course, on all these issues, whether it's the anti-Semitism issues we discussed or the Crusades, that there weren't mistakes made or there weren't people who went astray. Of course, those things happen. But is some of it maybe almost an anachronistic way we look back and judge previous generations by maybe our particular sensibilities of today?
Well, there's that too. I mean, let's say this about the Crusaders. They're a bunch of roughnecks. I mean, they were trained since they were little tiny boys to fight head-to-head, face-to-face with swords. These were not a bunch of, really housebroken, sophisticated, westernized guys. They were roughnecks. And they broke a lot of commandments, and they lived as well as they could. But fundamentally, along with all of that, they were very, very pious. About 40 years before the first crusade to the Holy Land, the Pope called for a crusade to Spain to help drive the Muslims out of Spain. Spain was close. They didn't have to go all the way to the Holy Land. And there was lots of loot and good things to be had in Spain had they gone down there. But nobody went. And the reason they didn't go is that because Jesus hadn't walked the streets of Seville. It was not Palestine. It was not Jerusalem. Mm. They went for religious reasons.
We're talking with Dr. Rodney Stark, a professor at Baylor and author of Bearing False Witness, Debunking Centuries of Anti-Catholic History. What about the Inquisition? That's always one that gets brought up.
Oh, I know. Now, there is a time, there was the greatest surprise I ever had in dealing with these kinds of materials. When I read that there were some people who were saying, the Inquisition wasn't bloody, and it was actually in many cases a real force for reason in this medieval world, I thought, oh, Lord, what kind of revisionist nuts have I run into now writing this kind of nonsense? And then I turned to read and see what some of them had to say and discovered, first of all, they were very eminent historians with wonderful credentials, like people from Harvard and Oxford and that sort of place. Secondly, they had access to material that was unmatched. The Catholic Church had given them access to the complete written records of 44,700 and some cases heard by the Spanish Inquisition. And they've even digitized them and put them into computer records at this point. But these were long, carefully written reports of each trial. And, it comes to be that maybe that they sentenced 10 people a year to death. Well, that's not 60,000, is it? Not only that, but some of the 10 would be commuted. Secondly, remember the witchcraft craze that went across Europe and took a whole lot of lives? It didn't happen in Spain or Italy, and the reason it didn't is the Inquisition didn't believe in it. It said nonsense. This is craziness. And so they hanged a few people for burning witches, not for being witches, and that put a stop to it and kept it out of Spain, kept it out of Italy. And we're talking now about a group of historians who've published this sort of stuff at great length. Anyone can look at it and evaluate it for themselves. By the way, in every chapter, I make a point of taking four or five or six or seven of these really leading historians whose material I'm really reprocessing, and and writing little biographies of them, putting them in a big box on a couple of pages so anybody can easily track it all down for themselves. Don't take my word for it.
I will say it's outstanding research and very well cited. Talk about science for just a minute. We touched on that a little bit with Columbus and this myth that everybody else believed the Earth was flat. That's another common attack against the Catholic Church, that the Church has been anti-science, when really some of the greatest scientists through history have been actually Catholics and some Catholic priests.
Yes. This is all craziness. The notion that science finally burst forth in the 17th and 18th centuries, having been suppressed all these centuries by the Catholic Church, is crazy. What happened in that particular period, the wonderful events in science that happened then, were simply science coming of age, normal scientific progress over a period of three and four centuries, building up in Catholic universities. Half of the major players in the scientific revolution were Catholic. Many of them were priests. One was a cardinal. Among the Protestants, they were with one exception, they were very pious men. Newton wrote a lot more theology than he did physics, for heaven's sakes. And there's a reason that science only happened in the West. It didn't happen anyplace else. And the reason was, only in the West did they think that the universe had been created by a rational God. That was the Judeo-Christian conception of God, not only a supreme being, very conscious and all those things, but rational, reasonable, and that he gave human beings reason, and therefore the universe would probably run on reasonable grounds that could be discovered by reasonable people. And they went out and looked, and darned if they didn't start discovering rules by which the universe operated. But nowhere else in the world did people believe that, so they didn't try to do science. They thought that all you could do about the universe was meditate.
We're talking with Dr. Rodney Stark, Baylor University professor and author of Bearing False Witness, Debunking Centuries of Anti-Catholic History. You talk about how these myths continue to perpetuate themselves, some for centuries, some more recently. Do you think, at least maybe even subconsciously, part of what is behind the energy of perpetuating these things is the Catholic Church is sometimes a moral voice of contradiction to some prevailing trends in the culture?
Yeah, well,
is there an idea that we're going to discredit the church's moral authority?
There are opponents of the Catholic Church, some of them ex-Catholics, some of them atheists, some of them militant Protestants, and then they take comfort in these myths, of course, because, you know, they prove that the bad guys are bad guys. And so they cherish them, and they spread them. But you know what? Something that's really distressing. Usually, if something is written by ex members of somebody, people who have quit, people who have dropped out of the Elks Club, or have been cut by the football team, or whatever, we take what they say with a grain of salt and some suspicion that they may have an axe to grind. But in the case of fallen away Catholics, angry ex-nuns, ex-seminarians and whatnot, when they write about the church, everybody says, boy, this must be the truth, because these people were really in a position to know. They never take it with a grain of salt. And that's very unfortunate. I mean, we've gotten over an awful lot of our history of anti-Catholicism, but they're little lingering pieces of it. And frankly, these days, it's the anti-religious who are mostly responsible for keeping it going.
Well, Dr. Stark, now that you've set the historical record straight, what do you think we can be doing going forward to help change the conventional wisdom, confront these myths? Is it a hopeless cause, or are there things we can actually do?
No, I don't think. I mean, things are very, very different than they even were 10 years ago. Heavens, Baylor is the largest Baptist university in the world. For the last 2 years, we've been in a joint venture with Georgetown, a Jesuit university, building a center devoted to studies of religious freedom in Washington, D.C. And all this was announced at a papal audience 2 years ago. That was unthinkable even 10 years ago, let alone 20. Baylor was a hotbed of anti-Catholicism 20 years ago. I mean, these things do change. I didn't think I was just, whistling in the dark when I wrote the book. I thought that it might be possible that it was time that I could convince some people and that it might help.
Well, Dr. Stark, thank you for your intellectual honesty and courage to write the book and for taking this step. This will go certainly on my library shelf as a great go-to resource for these things. And thanks for taking time to be with us today. Blessings on your good work going forward.
Thank you very much for having me.
Take care. He's Dr. Rodney Stark, author of Bearing False Witness, Debunking Centuries of Anti-Catholic History. Take care. A great conversation there. What makes Rodney Stark, I think, extra credible on this, of course, not only the meticulous research that he notes in his book and going through all these myths that have taken such root in our culture and rooted in this, I think, desire that some have in the culture to want to believe the worst about the Catholic Church. And some of it, I think, is rooted in the desire to discredit the church's moral authority, for sure. Not that we haven't done our own things to discredit that from time to time, but also the fact that he's not Catholic himself. He has no dog in the fight, so to speak. And so he treats the Catholic Church fairly. Of course, as I would warn him, start treating the church fairly. Pretty soon you'll be fond of her as well. We'll be back. This is the Mike Allen Show. Fifteen minutes before the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show. Asking a question of the day. Have you ever been on a fad diet? South Beach, Atkins. As a Kim who commented, a hot dog and banana diet back in high school. Have you ever been on one? And what were the results, both short and long term? 573-4BREAD-4. Email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. Kathy has been waiting patiently. Kathy, welcome to the program.
Yeah, Mike. Let me turn my radio down. I just wanted to thank you for having Rodney Stark on. I think it's a wonderful, concise book to have on everybody's shelf. And I know when I pursue truth and get in lively discussions, rather than having several resources, that'll be great to have just one. And I admire his courage as a Protestant. That was a courageous ecumenical endeavor, and just hope everybody can put it on their library bookshelf as well.
Yeah, it's really thorough. It's extensive. He deals with almost every old, charge that gets thrown up. And, apologetics has their limits, of course. No one was ever argued into faith per se, but it's nice when you can at least remove obstacles for people.
Right, and not have to have 10 books to do it, just
yeah,
have
that's
one.
Yeah, that's exactly.
Condensation of it's going to be nice. So, and yes, I have been on a special diet. That Atkins diet was an eye-opener for me because I found my carb threshold and lost about 40 pounds. Of course, it's something that you have to do every day, but if everybody can find out how carbs are killing us and what your threshold is, I strongly advise it.
Yeah,
not the radical version, but one where you, if you have a carb sensitivity, that you get on that and find how to play around with it.
Absolutely. Like I said, my only concern was, my wife went on it and she had trouble with her kidneys, which the doctor who dealt with her said that was a pretty common malady for people on the Atkins diet. Too much protein.
Too much protein and a long term, but it gets you started thinking about your carb intake. And then, like in moderation, you can back off. No, I don't think Atkins long term and drastic, like getting carbs a day. No, you're going to go into a kidney issue and other things. My hair, I've started to lose some of my hair. But when you back off and get that happy medium, then, you know, it's good.
Balance. So all about balance.
Balance. I'll hang up because I'm getting over this railroad track.
All right. Take care, Kathy.
Thanks, Mike.
Bye-bye. Yeah, don't be like that lady I talked about a couple days ago in the What Were You Thinking segment who, like, within a two-week period had two near misses with trains because she drove around the bar that came down the block at the railroad crossing, Kathy. Don't do that. We need you. 5734-BREAD-4, 5734-BREAD-4. Yeah, we're always looking for some angle, you know, on a diet. You know, it made me think of that scene from The Nutty Professor 2, which I would not recommend for devotional watching or anything. But, you know, Mrs. Klump, of course, played by Eddie Murphy, says, it doesn't matter what you eat as long as you wash it down with some grapefruit juice. It's going to take more than that. 5734-BREAD-4. You can chime in or email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. We were talking toward the beginning of the hour about an interesting new Indiana law set to kick in this summer that basically any unborn child who dies, whether that child dies via miscarriage, whether that child dies via abortion, that it will not be, the child will not be treated as medical waste, but will be disposed of or buried, interred in some means as a human person. And, you know, there's, I guess, part of the thought is that people will get more accustomed to thinking of the unborn human person as a person. And, you know, it as I said, the Atlantic, which is a publication that I usually have a great appreciation for, was peppered throughout the beginning of the article with the word fetus, which is treated somehow as, I guess, in some circles, particularly those which are pro-legalized abortion circles, as a euphemism of sorts that doesn't make you say the inconvenient word of baby. So you say fetus as some sort of a substitute, even though the word is really it simply means an unborn human person, right? And I was talking about that, and I came across actually a graph, interestingly enough, of the use of the word fetus in a popular, let's see, what was it that I came up with here that I saw? Yeah, it was the use of the word fetus over time, and kind of stayed pretty even until, somewhere around 1970, right around the time of Roe v. Wade. And then all of a sudden there was an enormous spike in this graph and how often the word fetus was used, because once legalized abortion became a reality in this country, we have to come up with terminology that at some level cloaks, I guess, the reality of the killing that's happening. So anyway, up in Indiana, this is going to be a case. It says for women who choose to have an abortion, the process can still end once the pills are swallowed or the stirrups are down. If families choose not to handle the disposal process, hospitals and clinics are responsible for taking care of the remains, along with the funeral and cemetery business with which they work. Absent state-mandated funerals or car rides to the crematorium, women don't have to help their fetuses come to a dignified end. Abortion providers and funeral directors will be the only witnesses to the interment or cremation. So I think I think it's a very good thing. It's a very hopeful thing, because even in, even in states that are relatively pro-life, even in sometimes hospitals that are church-oriented hospitals, people who have gone through a miscarriage, for example, have had a hard time even getting the hospital to release to them the body of this unborn child, which, my brothers and sisters, this should not be. If we really believe in the humanity of the person from conception and natural death, this should be part and parcel. So kudos to the state of Indiana for making this into a law, for sure. One other thing I wanted to mention, and didn't get a chance to get to it yesterday, Pope Francis has had another interview this time with a French newspaper called La Croix, and he was asked about clericalism. clericalism is that tendency to focus in the Catholic Church primarily on the work of the clergy as being either more significant or, more important. Let's see. We got Shannon calling in. Sorry about that. Shannon, welcome into the program.
I'm sorry. I didn't know if there's a limit to how many times you could call, but the first time I called was before.
It's like taking communion. You can do it twice a day with no penalty.
Okay, well, I wanted to comment about the burial of, because I'm sure there are many listeners who have experienced this as well. But we had a miscarriage several years ago, a miscarriage before, I guess, what would be medically considered death of a child. It was 16 weeks gestation. I think it's 20 weeks. They consider it a full, not full term, but death. Is that right? Or
I'm not sure what the policy
anyway,
is on that.
For like insurance purposes, maybe. I don't know. But anyway, it was 16 weeks. And we were, we desired to have the baby buried. And I had this, it was very strange. I'd never gone through this whole situation before the moment that it happened. When I found out about it in the actual hospital, I didn't know. But so there was lots of crazy things going on in my head. But anyway, when I had mentioned to my gynecologist that we wanted to have the remains buried, wanted to have possession of them when after the miscarriage were allowed to take place, she had this very strange look on my, you want the remains? Mm. You know, they act like, now I don't want to see them, and I know what they are and all that stuff, but that what the reason was to bear, burial
proper
and everything.
Burial.
Which we went through, it was very life-affirming for
yes.
me, and I thought it was a wonderful opportunity for my kids, who were young at the time, to think of
yes.
our child having passed, even though we never got to meet him. But so I think it's a good thing. I'm pro that,
I think, that seemed like that would be something. Of course, there will be those pro-choice people who will be opposed to it, of course, because they see it as an undermining of their cause. But I think that's unfortunate. And,
But even at 16 weeks, we got you get those commemorative birth certificates from the hospital. They're not real birth certificates, but they have the hospital writing on it and all that stuff, and the handprint and footprints and all that. We actually got footprints.
Wow.
And they were the size of just a human adult thumb, and you could see the feet. There's just no denying it was. And we have something. I think we have a memorial. We have in Calvary Cemetery a special place for miscarried children, and a memorial. I think in Frankfurt.
Yeah, so. there are, that's increasing. I think all over the country, those kind of memorials. And like I said, it's a great gift. And I
and
think
even
hopefully
inviting women, mothers of aborted and listing aborted children.
Mm-hmm.
Also, in those memorials, I think is, it allows some women to
yes.
come to terms with that and receive mercy in that decision, later on. So I think.
Shannon, thanks for the call. We're about out of time. I really appreciate it. All right, we'll be back tomorrow by God's grace. Thanks to CB working the board, Keith screening calls, Kathy and Shannon for the calls. We'll be back tomorrow. This is the Mike Allen Show.